Sponsorship for Marketing Voices is provided by Intel, the world leader in silicon innovation.
This is Marketing Voices, featuring the fresh perspectives of industry leaders and examining the impact of social media on marketing.
Hi, it's Jennifer Jones. Welcome to Marketing Voices. Today I have a very special show for you because I was recently at the National Venture Capital Association meeting in Santa Clara, California, and I was the only one that was allowed to record the keynote conversation at the meeting between John Doerr, general partner of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, and Mike Moritz, general partner of Sequoia Capital. Now, these are two of the most incredibly successful VCs who backed Google and many other technology companies. The interview runs about 45 minutes, and I really thank the NVCA for allowing me to record it, as well as Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia Capital. So without any more ado, here's the interview.
Our first keynote today is a combined keynote. And we asked two of the most successful venture capitalists in the history of mankind. Between them, they have returned mega billions to investors, two fierce competitors who in the past have teamed up to help build one of the most successful venture-backed companies in history, but have also fought one another on the proverbial Sandhill Road battlefield. They come here today in front of you all with a no-holds-barred Q&A. It is my honor to invite up here the Wizard of Wales, Mike Moritz, and the man who put the hyper in hyperbole, John Doerr, my partner.
I was going to see how Mike would do on his own.
Well, John has packed the audience here. He has three of his partners in the front row.
Five.
Five.
In fact, I'd like to name them. May I do that?
Hopelessly outnumbered.
May I name them?
Please.
So I'm very proud. I've been a partner of Brooke Byers's for the longest time. Gosh, 30 years or so. Juliet Flint, John Denniston, Dana Mead's here, Wen Shea's here. All the rest are in the Middle East or Asia or...
Good. There's nobody on Sandhill Road working. I'm relieved to hear. So I got one question, John. As you know, we emailed everybody to get solicitations of questions. And the first burning question that came in over the ether was, you have to ask John this. How many communication devices has he brought with him today?
Honestly? Yeah, so I got a couple of computers, the Lenovo and the Mac Air are terrific. Three phones, including an iPhone, a voice recorder.
And that's just that's, in your left-hand pocket.
That'd be it.
So do I get to go first? Okay. So
can I ask you a question?
Please.
Yeah. So I haven't prepped Mike on this question. It's going to be really, he and I have discussed this many times before. And it's a subject I should save a little bit of contention, but I think we're in front of everybody in our industry now, and we can be honest. I'm really interested in what it was that you thought when I called and referred Google to you. Fess up. Come on now.
He's been working on that one line for a very long time. I said, John, can you spell it?
I am grateful you joined that investment. Next.
So, I've been burning to ask you this for a very long time. I grew up in Wales. Nobody has Roman numerals after their name in Wales. That's largely because most of them all have the same last name. You have a Roman numeral 3, which leads me to believe that there were two other John Doerrs, at least, that came before you. Tell us about them.
There still are. There's my dad, who's my hero. He lives in St. Louis, Missouri. He's an engineer and a sales guy. Does that sound familiar? And then my grandfather, Louis Doerr the first, was a mechanical engineer and an entrepreneur, started a machine shop, invented a tugboat drive mechanism. So. Mm-hmm. All my brothers and sisters are in St. Louis, and I've dropped that third thing because it feels a little pretentious, but I'm really proud of my dad and my granddad.
So now we know what the L stands for.
Yeah, for Lewis. Exactly right.
Good.
So, Mike, here's what I'm really interested in. I've got some professional questions. I've got some personal questions. Then I have some partnership questions. So these are the three Ps. And the first one I want to go to is the partnership, because I've... read in the press that Sequoia is hiring some money managers, and I've seen you open funds all around the world. And I wonder, is that true? What's the strategy here for the partnership?
Well, Becky Buckman from the Wall Street Journal is the person, I think she's in the audience today. She seems to know more than the rest of the world knows, and we're keeping our lips very tightly sealed on those things. But the hires that were you read about and other people read about in the journal the other day are true, but it's far too early for us to want to elaborate, even in front of a friendly audience like this.
And is there more press here than Becky? Yes. All right. Thank you for that information.
Yeah.
personal question. What's the deal with these socks, these Argyle socks?
You need some spice in life. I just decided in the future, and it's rare these days, obviously, that anyone wears ties, so I just in the future start wearing my ties around my feet. It was way easier that way. Yeah. So now let me turn the tables a little bit on you, John. So you won't remember this, but I have a very vivid memory of this, maybe now almost 30 years ago. I had just joined Time Magazine in San Francisco, and Brooke will remember this as well. I had done a little story on Kleiner Perkins, and coming out of, I was going over, I think, to see Brooke or Tom Perkins to interview them, and then I saw a man in a hurry rushing out of the Embarcadero building, because your office used to be up in the Embarcadero building, with a huge pile of magazines. I've never seen anyone carry quite so many magazines under his hand. And that was John Doerr.
Keep going.
Rushing away. So, but I wanted to go back a little further than that, and thank you, which was to ask you, what took you to Intel in the first place? I've never...
My girlfriend had dumped me. Ann Holland was her name, and she had gotten a summer job at Intel.
A woman of obviously great wisdom.
Yeah, indeed. Plus, I was a royal pain in the ass at the time, and frantic about trying to put together this relationship. And so she came to Silicon Valley. She didn't tell me where she was going to work. I figured out that she was at Intel, so I had no job. I'd applied to work for all the venture capital firms in 1974. Only one company went public that year. I think it was Playboy, so venture capitalists weren't hiring. But I figured out she was at Intel, and I badgered my way ultimately into an appointment, a job interview with Bill Davidow of our industry. And he really wanted to get rid of me, so he passed me down to Jim Lally, who passed me down to Urs Bremplis, who passed me down to Sam Sattler. And at the end of that, I got a summer job writing benchmarks for the Intel 8-bit microcomputers. And the most amazing thing happened. They put me in an office, catty corner across the aisle from my girlfriend who wasn't speaking to me. So this is a really terrific, lucky
summer. And back then,
you
couldn't even email her.
I couldn't email her, and she couldn't avoid me. And by the end of the summer, we put it all back together.
And it all ended happily ever after, right? Because you wound up marrying
Ed. Well, it's looking good so far. So, Mike, how about your family? How did you meet your lovely wife?
I met Harriet in San Francisco. She was she had come out from the East Coast finishing writing a book, and that was more than almost 25 years ago now. And
both authors, both writers.
Yeah.
And did you meet in a library or a bar? Or a
we met over a hot typewriter. a mutual friend introduced us. But
who's that mutual friend?
It was a lady who worked at the New York Times.
Oh, all right. So, and do you remember what you first said to her?
I'm late. Some things never change.
And she said?
I said, you're right, you're late. So,
very cool.
So after you got hired at Intel, John, I think people are interested in what it was like working at Intel, because I think Intel has just watching you in action all around the valley for a long time. Intel has really colored you in many ways. Tell everybody a little bit about the enduring lessons that you took away from those 6 or 7 or 8 years it might have been while you were working at Intel.
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I guess a lesson I learned from Intel is that culture really matters. And to my amazement, I was a summer student there part-time when I first started. And this guy, Andy Grove, who Bill David Au told me was the guy really running the business. It wasn't Noyce or Moore, and that was true. Put on this course called IOPEC for Intel Organization, Philosophy, and Economics. And he said, we've surveyed the Intel culture, and this is who you are, who we are, so let's be this way. And he said, we're aggressive introverts. We know how to confront problems without confronting the people. If you don't measure things, they don't matter. Everybody will write down objectives and key results every month, every quarter. We'll check those off. We want to be a risk-taking kind of place. Growth really, really matters. Winning really, really matters. Integrity is a binary state. You don't ever cross over the line, but you fight really hard to win. And the other lesson that I got is that when places grow a lot, that makes a lot of opportunity, because who would have let a, you know, maybe I was a little more than a teenager, but a kid go into that company and train the sales force or develop benchmarks. So I admired the leaders. I admired the company. I think for many years it's been one of the best managed technology companies
and
ever.
And when you, before you joined Kleiner Perkins, what was your last job at Intel? What were you doing?
At Intel. I was the marketing manager for a failed line of microprocessors called the Intel 8800, which was a 16 to 32-bit set of self-dispatching multiple processor processors. We had a slogan for this line of processors. It said, if you've got the time, we've got the machine. And fortunately, after I left, they were able to sell this to the great Siemens Corporation. But, Mike, I want to go into your background. Now, you joined the professional world as a journalist for Time Magazine, and you interviewed Steve Jobs, wrote a famous book about Steve, and I believe your entree to Sequoia was an interview that you did with Don Valentine. Is all that true or not?
It is. It's roughly true. It's not quite as true today as it was 30 years ago, but if you had a business card that said Time Magazine on it, you could pretty much get in and talk to anybody.
Even Brooke Ryers. Anybody in the world.
In 1978. Yeah. And people behind the desk, inevitably, I always used to be amused by this. I'd be interviewing some bigwig in a company, scribbling in my notebook, and the telephone would go, and the bigwig would pick up the phone, and he'd say, I can't talk to you right now. I'm talking to Time Magazine. And it was at that point that I realized I'd better get out of journalism. And but that's how I first met Don, and actually that was how I first met Tom Perkins as well, and Arthur Rock, who wouldn't talk to me. And Arthur Rock, and people probably don't know this, Arthur Rock, along with Mussolini and Hitler, is one of the three people to have appeared on the cover of Time Magazine who never granted the editors of Time Magazine an interview.
Wow.
And they got their revenge by putting him on the cover and dressing him up in a jacket. This was an artist's rendition, a jacket covered in $100 bills.
In other words, don't mess with the people with the ink. It was in 1974 that, among others, I tried to interview with Arthur Rock. He refused to meet with me, just as he did you. So we have that in common. But one of his partners, God bless Dick Kramley, he took the meeting, and he said, you know, John, I think you ought to get a real job. Forget about looking for venture capital. We have this tiny little chip company down in Santa Clara, California, by the name of Intel, and I think you should go get a job there. And I'm forever grateful to Dick Kramley for that.
Tell us another part of it. I've read about this. Again, I've never talked to you about it. Tell us about visiting the personal computer show. I think it was in 1979. Towing Andy Grove in your wake.
Yes.
Do you recall the
circumstances? I do recall that story. I'd been with Regis McKenna lobbying that Intel ought to build a personal computer, very much like the compact computer, you know, the luggable suitcase. Well, you guys don't know it. You're too young. With a screen. So I wasn't getting very far. So I got Andy to agree to come up to this personal computer show with me. It was called the First West Coast PC Fair, F-A-I-R-E. There was a guy by the name of Jim Warren who was roller skating around the place. You walked right into the first booth, and there was the Apple booth with the Apple II and Don Bryson showing VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet. It was amazing. This thing would recalculate in a moment. So I took Grove from booth to booth to booth, Not for very long. He was quite an impatient man. And by the time we got to about the third book, Ruth, he said, "Thor, are you crazy? These people are a bunch of hobbyists." And he walked out. You know, it's these little plastic bags. And so for that, Intel's not in the personal computer industry.
Hmm. You saved them from it.
I don't know. Well, perhaps. So, Mike, can we go to the professional as opposed to the partnership? What is your view of the venture capital industry today and its prospects compared to a decade ago? And you have to be really credible and honest here. I don't want to hear something that is, oh, it's better than it's ever been before. Give us some puts and takes, some pros and cons.
Well, when people, look, obviously both Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia Capital have ventured outside the United States. I mean, we've all traveled to the same places, observed the same trends, had the great good fortune of being able to, in part, look at the road ahead through the illumination of the lights of the companies in which we're an investor. So it's obvious what's happening to the world around us. But I think there are a lot of people who are prepared to write off Silicon Valley prematurely. I think certainly in our professional lifetimes, is certainly still going to be a wonderful place to make investments. But the fact of the matter is that if you want to be an investor in the world's great technology companies of tomorrow, increasingly the market share of the great technology companies that's contributed by U.S. companies is going to diminish. Is it going to go to, I don't know, 70% or 50% in our lifetimes? Probably not. But I think we also wanted to be sure that, certainly at Sequoia, we didn't make the mistake that besets a lot of companies in which we invest or we have experience with, which is to assume that tomorrow is going to be like yesterday. And obviously there are risks associated with making venture investments outside of Silicon Valley, but we thought we couldn't ignore the trends that were around us. But, you know, every time people whine about there's too much money in Silicon Valley or it's too competitive or there are all these people doing small investments or the big guys are coming in, certainly since I've been in the business in 1986, those sorts of laments have been pretty constant.
Through it all, yeah.
That's life. And we're still pretty darned upbeat, just I suspect as you are, about all the opportunities that are on our doorstep. But I think this is also a business, as everybody who's a practitioner of the venture capital business knows and who's an investor in the venture capital business, like all other businesses, most of the returns accrue to a small group of firms. And I think nothing's going to change there.
What's the best thing about being at Sequoia and being in the venture capital business for you?
I think there are two aspects to it, one of which is having to stay perpetually young at heart, because as soon as you get too crusty or leathery or cynical, you don't believe it's possible anymore with somebody who's 21 years old and 22 years old.
Right.
I think the other aspect, given what we're doing, is it sure beats, you know, sitting at home in front of the mirror watching your hair fall out. but I think it's the stimulation and also the fact that we set ourselves some new challenges as well, which are real challenges, and we've got to see whether or not we can meet them. But it puts another set of goals in front of all of us.
You've had some storied senior partners, Don Valentine, Pierre LaMonde. I've known both of them. Many here have also. Mm-hmm. What do you emulate from them and not emulate? This goes to lessons learned for Mike Moritz.
I think it's a lot like companies. I remember writing when I first wrote about Apple and looking at the management team at Apple, and there was a person from Hewlett-Packard, and there was a person from Intel, and there was a person from National Semiconductor, and all of those, and probably some other companies, and I've forgotten their names. And there were aspects of each of those companies that the man, that Steve and Mike Markler, who was running Apple at the beginning, absorbed and brought into their company. But Apple became their own company with its own very distinctive hallmark. And I think that's how I think about where we make investments. That's how I've always thought about Don and Pierre and other people that I've, other partners at Sequoia Capital. You make an investment, you learn something from it. Even
But is there something specific about Don and Pierre that you really like or don't like?
Well, you pick the aspects that you admire.
And what are those?
And, I think Pierre is a ferocious competitor, and Don is an incredible salesman. And there are a few which sort of reminds me of one question I wanted to ask you as well.
Yeah, but you haven't finished answering my question. Nice try. Oh, you are finished.
So...
So let's go here.
And well, let me think. Let me elaborate a little bit.
While I ask my next question.
No, let me. So I think Don has got very clear communication skills. People who have been on the receiving end of some of those particular deployment of those skills may not have always appreciated it, but clarity of communication and message helps tremendously. And I think I've always admired, have never pretended to emulate or even be able to mimic. You know, Pierre's natural affinity, given his background with people, engineers and programmers, and have always admired that.
If you were starting a new venture capital fund right now in this environment, how would you do it? How would you compete? We got hundreds, hundreds and hundreds of venture capital firms out here.
I probably would board a vessel at the San Francisco pier belonging to the Neptune Society and ask for a burial at sea.
Oh, really? Really? No, you're in that position now. That's a funny but not acceptable answer.
I'd probably go to a market where there isn't a lot of... I probably wouldn't do it in Silicon Valley. I'd probably try and pick a market elsewhere, which is off the beaten track, probably outside of North America, and try and earn my stripes there in a quiet fashion and do it with people who really understand the topography and domain of that particular market or that particular market niche. So let me ask you this, John. Having been on the receiving end... unfortunately, of your, and I'm not pandering or currying favor here, of your selling skills. Where have you picked up your selling skills? And I don't know if all of you have seen John in full action, whether live or on video, I suspect. And this is one of the more remarkable sales people you will ever meet. Where did you pick them all up, and when did you start to really excel at it?
Well, I had a job at Intel to sell, and if I didn't sell, I would get fired. So I went to Dale Carnegie's School of Selling, very nervous. I had $1 million quota, and I decided the best way to sell is to be very understated, to try really hard. Those who know me know that's not true. But actually, if you solve a problem, you get an order. So for Intel, it was a very consultative kind of selling, right? If you help them design a microprocessor into a solution, and there was genuineness and warmth. Lo and behold, I worked out, walked out of my first sales call. This is 1978 with an order for $100,000. I was just flabbergasted. How did that happen? That's where I learned.
Now, did they send you to Dale Carnegie, or you allowed to go?
No, I did that on my nickel. I was really afraid I wouldn't make it. Yeah.
And was that useful, the Dale Carnegie?
Yeah. One of the things, certainly a lesson that I remember is, when you've got the order, shut up. So where did you acquire the skills to be a great venture investor? How'd you learn that?
I'm always still a little hesitant about that because, as I suspect you are and everybody else who's experienced some successful investments, because as soon as you think you know what you're doing, you get a rude comeuppance, and you fall on your backside and have to pick yourself up off the mat again. And so I'm always amazed when somebody thinks I actually
Or a successful venture investor?
Who here thinks
Mike's a successful venture investor?
So
about 10% of the audience.
Yeah, right. There are 90% of the very wise.
So what lessons do you impart to younger partners at Sequoia if they come and say, Mike, at your knee, how do you do it? What should I do to develop to be better? In the ruthless, fierce, backstabbing environment of Sequoia Capital.
That's right. Where there is, I should
take blood, no prisoners.
Exactly.
Blood on the floor.
Blood dripping down the walls. Of course, there's no wallpaper on there either.
We'll get to that.
Yeah. I think watching and listening are two virtues that. There are a lot of opinions in the venture capital business, but watching and listening and occasionally express sentiments often serve you extremely well in this business, because you actually make very, very few decisions. And you've got to make sure that those few decisions, let's assume that you get deeply involved with one or two investments a year. You're in the business 15 years, you have 30 major decisions that you're going to make. If you get half of them right, you're okay. But if the balance goes the other way, you'll look back at a lifetime where you have erred. And I think just a ruthless evisceration of the facts and setting opinion by the door and leaving it outside the room has, on the whole, served us fairly well. Just looking at the facts, casting aside prejudice, casting aside opinion. Because I think, as you know full well, received opinion, the heritage of the past, all of that stuff is going to preclude you from making an investment in a new area that may be out of fashion or hasn't hit other people's radar screen yet, or would seem fairly preposterous to most people.
I'm reminded as Mike talks, this is just an aside, it's not a question, that I've been on boards with Mike, and he's such a smart guy. I mean, the way that he uses language, and he doesn't talk a lot either. I'm getting a lot out of him in front of all of us. But in a board meeting, he says relatively few things, and people really listen. And I admire that you can offer advice in the form of stories, storytelling, as opposed to you should do this, you should do that, you should do that. And I certainly, and I think many of us here, wish we enjoyed your intellect and command of the language. Okay, stop pandering.
Yes, exactly. I got a question for you, John, which is a question, again, one of these mailing questions. How come the firm isn't called Kleiner Perkins Caulfield Byers and Dorr?
It's not a very good idea. I don't like being called Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, although I will tell you that one time, Brooke went away on sabbatical, right, Brooke? 30 days. You know, Brooke is so fastidious. And while he left, we actually did take his name out of the door, changed the name on the door and the business cards, and moved his office from the corner to a small carol. And that was a very fun day at Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Dorr.
So when did you join Kleiner?
1980.
And how was the firm run when you joined it?
Well, Perkins was, Eugene Kleiner had retired. Perkins was a very strong-willed partner, but he wasn't in charge. It was very clear that both Brooke and Frank were able to go toe-to-toe with Tom. And I don't remember exactly, but I imagine I was pretty intimidated by him and also probably pretty pushy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how was it run? We got around a table on Mondays and we made investment decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Perkins, though, was remarkable. I remember I think the first couple of months I was there, Genentech went public. You know, fireworks in San Francisco, that was the start of the whole recombinant DNA biotech industry. And then I noticed that Tom, in his spare time, got on the phone with people like Pitch Johnson and others, spare time, and raised about a $20 million partnership to buy the Bugatti automobile collection from a Las Vegas hotel. And, you know, I saw other venture firms trying to raise money to invest in ventures. They couldn't do it. So Perkins certainly had a magic touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was the first investment that you got deeply involved with when you were at Kleiner?
One of them, I think, was a company called Seek, which was some refugees from Intel who left to make E-squared memory devices. And I remember being terrified. Frank Caulfield went on the board. But Intel decided to sue me, a recent Intel refugee, and our partnership for theft of trade secrets, you know, the usual sort of thing. And I thought I'd be fired or they'd win or something like that. And Frank Caulfield stood up right to the plate and said, we're going to countersue them for defamation. And, you know, they would have lost, so we settled. Mm-hmm.
And then you became a director at Seek? And
Well, I think I was a director of Seek at the time. Yeah. Gordy Kim. Yeah.
Now, some years later, I've always wondered about this. After Kleiner, and I think you'd been a director of Sun Microsystems for some years by then, someday you must have gotten up and said you wanted to go and work at Sun Microsystems. And I don't know if everybody remembers this, but you went, you took a year off or something, and you went to work,
I took a sabbatical. One thing is when I joined Kleiner, I actually didn't want to be in venture capital. I really wanted to start a company with friends like my dad did. So a condition of employment was they promised they'd back me in a startup. And there's a reason for me telling you these two stories, if you'll humor me a bit more. We started a company called Silicon Compilers with Carver Mead down in Caltech, and I tried to be the CEO of it for 9 months or a little over a year, and I learned a lot about what I wasn't able to do, and we ultimately got a better CEO than me to run the business. But I've always loved startups and felt honestly inadequate to the task of advising entrepreneurs. That particularly got to be the case, as you point out, a few years later when some of the businesses that I'd invested in, our partnership had invested in, let me correct that, Compaq Computer, they'd gotten to be really big businesses. And here was this 30-year-old kid on the board of a, you know, multiple $100 million company. And how could I advise Rod Canyon or some of the people, or Jim Barksdale? And I clearly couldn't. So I asked to take a sabbatical, and I went to work at Sun because I wanted to try managing a large operation. Mm-hmm. They had about 4,000 people in the desktop division. And suddenly I found myself managing through managers of managers, and I didn't know the names of all the people in the group. Totally foreign from my experience. I really loved it. I almost didn't come back to Kleiner Perkins. Mm-hmm. And
Now, is that something that you would suggest for younger partners today at Kleiner Perkins or elsewhere around the venture business that they go do? Or
I don't know about around the... I guess I'd suggest it around the venture business, and I think it's super important at Kleiner Perkins. So our partners generally have some entrepreneurial or operating experience. One of my partners I'm really proud of, Aileen Lee, is on the board of a great solar company, Mia Soleil, and at the same time is running one of our investments called Danu. Now, time's going to tell how that works out, but I think it's worth bearing in mind that I heard Dave Marquardt say this first. I think the venture capital business is a service business. We're trying to serve entrepreneurs. We keep that in mind. And the really successful players in a service industry look a lot like their entrepreneurs. Not always, but usually. So McKinsey looks like the CEOs, you know what I'm saying. If our goal is to serve entrepreneurs, we're a lot better off if we've been in their shoes when things go crazy or disastrous. We don't immediately panic, and we can help them along the way. So I think that's a good thing.
Let me switch topics. There are few people around anywhere, I think, who've had the good fortune of being very close to a remarkable set of individuals in different businesses over three or four different decades now. Mm. Like you. Give us your first impressions, if you can remember back when, of a bunch of different people. And I'll just throw some names at you, perhaps starting way back when at, it's not really at the beginning of time, but Lotus Development was a Kleiner Perkins company, an early personal computer software investment. Mitch Kapoor, where did you first meet him? First impressions.
I met him in the parking lot of the now torn down Hyatt Regency, Ricky's Hyatt in Palo Alto. He had on a Hawaiian T-shirt and looked pretty much like he was, which is a devotee of transcendental meditation who had worked as a disc jockey. That was Mitch.
Right. The wonderful founder of...
And he's a good friend to this day.
And I think the next gentleman is also a good friend to this day of yours. The founder of Intuit, Scott Cook.
Hmm. Scott. Scott was a consultant and a graduate of Procter & Gamble, a superb marketeer. and he was actually a classmate of mine at business school, and somehow when he did the first financing of Intuit, he didn't come to see us, but we competed for a follow-on round of financing. And what I remember about Scott is still Scott today. If you don't know him, he's a super smart guy, great board member. He was on the board of Amazon, was on the board of eBay, and very, very customer-oriented. Great father also, great dad.
Yeah. Mark Andreessen.
Mark Andreessen, he's a big, hulking, very successful entrepreneur who loves burgers at the Creamery in Palo Alto. And I'll not forget soon how smart he is, how fast he talks, and how he recruited a half dozen other rebels from the University of Illinois to turn the world upside down with this point-and-click browser. Excuse me for reminiscing for a moment, but do you realize that 14 years ago, there was no web browser? This whole thing that we take for granted, click on the picture and go there, is just a little over a decade ago. It's really created a lot of opportunity for all of us.
And where did you first encounter Jeff Bezos?
He bounded down from the second story of a loft opposite the Free Needle Clinic in the CD part of Seattle with his trademark honk and laugh. And I knew that very minute before we looked at the business or negotiated, which was really hard, that I wanted to be in trouble with him. Mm-hmm. He was a special entrepreneur.
Had you been an Amazon customer before you met Jeff?
Yeah, but you know what's more telling than that is when you went back in the Amazon shipping area, the books were lined up so you could see what people were buying. And there was a funny thing about it. It was the early adopters. So invariably there was a book about a programming language, such as Java. And in the same order was a book about the joy of sex. So these were clearly probably male nerds who had no social or sex life trying to get help from an online service.
Uh-huh.
And I do have another piece of advice. That correlates more with any other success factor that I've seen in the world's greatest internet entrepreneurs. And if you look at Bezos, or you look at Andreessen, or you look at Jerry Yang and David Filo, or you look at the founders of Google, or you look at name another great internet company. It's even true of the Sun founders. They all seem to be white male nerds who've dropped out of Harvard or Stanford, and they have absolutely no social life. So when I see that pattern coming in, which was true of Google, it was very easy to decide we ought to invest.
I think they call that pattern recognition.
Yeah.
What so, about the... here's a different question for you. Those are some of the great entrepreneurs, obviously, that America has produced over the last quarter of a century. But what about the fish that got away? The company or companies that you rue the fact that Kleiner Perkins passed on the opportunity, having had an opportunity to...
One that we could have invested in that we didn't.
Yes.
We could have invested in VMware.
Mm.
Vinod proposed that we do that many times, and the valuation was always too high, $60 million, $100 million pre-money. And Vinod, what are you thinking?
Right.
But that's too bad. Should have done that. It's hard to invest at those higher valuations. So, Mike, if you could wave a wand and change anything about the industry that we're in, the way we are, the way we conduct our business, the way the world works for us, what would that be?
I think there's a lot of hot air and arrogance in the business that we would all be better off without. A lot of useless pontificating in front of entrepreneurs who are devoting their lives and working a lot harder than we are on their particular enterprises, and not enough focus on making sure that that entrepreneur feels that and justifiably feels and believes 10 years after he's started working with Kleiner Perkins or started working with Sequoia Capital or started working with us both, that that was one of the best business decisions of his or her life. I don't think people think like that.
I really like the way you say that. I feel a similar way, but it's very eloquent. And if I may, without your asking me, add something that we're doing at Kleiner and might serve our industry well or not, is we're really trying to watch our language. So we don't at Kleiner Perkins refer to new ventures as deals. If I could do any single thing, I'd get our industry to stop using the word deal. Because if you're an entrepreneur, do you want to walk into somebody's venture capital shop and be known as a deal?
Well, I think there's one worse word than that. We have a similar sort of ethos and edict. But there's one word even lower down the vocabulary that tends to get used. And can you imagine how demeaning it is to an entrepreneur if you hear the business that you've dreamed about for a couple of years and you've labored hard over being called a project?
For example, these are the hopes and dreams of entrepreneurs. And so if, you know, we all could stop doing that, I think.
Let me ask you a different thing, which was another mailing question, which is everyone's very curious about the compromising photographs that Al Gore possesses of John Doerr.
I'm a huge Al Gore fan. I really wish he was president of the United States. I think it was a real shame that we didn't get those few hundred votes, but that's a quite political and maybe controversial statement here. When you get to know the man, and I hope that you do, he's up front and close, very warm, very personable, very smart, really good partner. He'll do anything you ask him to do, almost. And you know, he founded this investment management firm with David Blood to invest in large cap stocks. And they were going to call the thing Blood and Gore. Now, I was hoping that when we formed our alliance, it could be Blood, Gore, and Doerr, but it's not to be.
Well, it could be Blood, Gore, and Guts. Yeah. So let me ask you this. I see the clock is winding down here. If you had to guess, maybe ask the audience this question about how many investments Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia Capital have made together. Obviously, everybody associates Google, thankfully, with both of our firms.
Praise the Lord. It was a great referral, wasn't it? He's such a gentleman.
Any guesses?
Let's get a show of hands. How many think that Kleiner and Sequoia have invested through the history of the firms in fewer than 20 ventures? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, my God, we're getting to 10, 12, looks like 12%. How about
20 to 40.
20 to 40. How many people think the number is 20 to 40? There's another 12%.
Yeah, a lot of non-voters here. It's like Indiana last night. What about 50 or over? Ah, one. So it actually is right on 50. And I was saying to John just before we started here, there are only 6 letters of the alphabet that we haven't used up yet as the starting letter of a company in which we should invest. So I think you and I, John, we need to find a company that begins, and if anybody has a friend who's got a company with one of these letters, could they refer them and we'll make the investment together in this company? We need a company beginning with the letter H, J, Q, U, X, Y, or Z. And so that will fill out the alphabet for Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia Capital together.
Hey, Mike, I have a final question for you. Maybe you'd ask it for me so I know what's coming. What is it that keeps Mike Moritz going now? You've made enough money to send the kids to college, so.
Yeah. Although we were recently looking at an investment in a company that sold used textbooks that I thought would be quite interesting now that I have both boys at school. It's amusing and it's fun and it's diverting, and I can't imagine, maybe it's a tribute to the lack of imagination, I can't imagine anything that is more challenging, more testing, more nerve-wracking that I want to do. And what about you?
I think for me it's informed by our priorities, which Kevin Compton wrote on a little yellow sticky outside his office. And the first priority, everybody at Kleiner shares this, is family. So we found a way to work family into our venture business. You got to go home for something, you just do it. But the second, and the one often overlooked, is partners. And so I feel, I'm sure you feel similarly, but I want to say, I think it's a really great indulgence that I'm one of the custodians of this good reputation, fine reputation that Eugene and Tom built, and I get to work with partners, help them. They certainly helped me. They've kept me out of jail.
Tell us about that.
I will. It has to do with Martha Stewart. Maybe time will run out if I keep going. But it's an indulgence to work with these partners. They're diverse, they're smart, they're great, and what we're trying to do is have Kleiner Perkins be more than an episodic collection of some talented partners, but be something that can be, when the day comes that I'm doing something else, that
there can... Is that going to be soon, I hope?
I don't have any present plans. No, don't think so.
Ted, what do you want to do next? Where's Ted?
Sure. Yeah, we'll take, how about if we take three, it's up to you, but let's do three
You're
questions.
You're the chairman here.
He's the chairman. He's in charge.
From the audience.
Show of hands, please. Who wants a question? For Mr. Moritz.
I'd like to ask John Doerr what he would say to Bill Iraq nowadays.
I'd say he's an economic terrorist and he got his just rewards.
And he wasn't even in room 871.
So, question for you related to the DNA you're looking for in CEOs. You, being involved with a number of your companies, I've seen down to 21 years old, and then some very more senior statesmen. Just want to get an understanding of what you're looking for when you're making the investment or replacing a CEO.
Mike, over to you.
Well, John deserves all the credit for identifying and recruiting Eric Schmidt to Google. And I think Eric has the virtues of, particularly in these testosterone-charged companies that John was alluding to during the conversation here. I think it's wonderful to be able to find somebody like Eric or Dan Warmenhoven at Network Appliance, or John Morgridge, who was the first CEO at Cisco Systems, who doesn't have a need to be in the limelight, understands the virtues of and incredible gifts and talents and passions of the founders, and is a calming level influence who doesn't wear his emotion or her emotion on his or her sleeves. Those are the virtues that that we certainly look for. We're looking for people who can make the founders even better than they were at the beginning.
One more?
Yep.
Last question.
Would you guys have, if you were Yahoo, would you guys have strategically move to Microsoft?
Mike is an investor in both Yahoo and Google, so I think he's in a much better position than I am to offer any point of view on that. I defer to Mike.
And I'm also a close friend of Jerry's, and what I tell Jerry will be between the two of us. So I'd prefer, obviously, not to answer that question. Sorry.
Okay, well,
front, yes.
Listen, on that happy note, I'd like to thank everybody for all you do every day to make our industry a great service industry and the leadership of the NVCA. And I know for all the partners at Kleiner and at Sequoia, I can say we look forward to working with you. Let's help entrepreneurs build some great companies. Thank you. Good job.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, Michael.
So thank you for listening to Marketing Voices. I hope you enjoyed the interview. And if you'd like to make any comments, please join me at www.marketingvoices.com. And until next week, to all my listeners and viewers, may all the voices you hear be marketing voices.